Well, many people are familiar with Dr. Zhivago, the epic love story set during the Russian Revolution. What they might not know is the story of how the novel, written by Boris Pasternak, finally came to be published in Italy in 1957. The authorities in the Soviet Union didn't want the novel published, fearing it was critical of the revolution and therefore anti-Soviet. It was smuggled into Milan, published in the West, and earned Pasternak a Nobel Prize for Literature nomination. Dr. Zhivago was also smuggled back into the Soviet Union by the CIA, with the hope of destabilising the regime. A new book by Lara Prescott, The Secrets We Kept, reimagines the CIA's efforts to promote Dr. Zhivago, and the efforts in particular of women agents. Lara Prescott is with us from Texas. Hello, Lara.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. We had a burst of your theme music there. Is there a?
I love that song. I can't get enough of it.
Is there a coincidence in the name between, of course, the heroine of Dr. Zhivago, or one of the main characters, and your own name?
No, there. It is not a coincidence. My mother was a huge fan of Boris Pasternak's book, as well as the David Lean film adaptation. And so I grew up turning my mother's jewelry box over again and again so I could hear it play Lara's theme. And growing up watching Dr. Zhivago anytime it was on the television, and then finally reading the actual book when I was in high school. So it's been a part of my life since day one.
When did you learn of this side story to the novel itself?
Well, my father actually can claim credit for emailing me a link to the Washington Post article that first detailed the CIA's Zhivago mission. And the writers of that article, Peter Finn and Petra Kuve, they'd petitioned the CIA to release these documents because it had been a long-standing rumor that the CIA had this role in publishing their own version of Dr. Zhivago and smuggling it back behind the Iron Curtain where it was banned. But it was never confirmed until 2014, and they finally released about 100 documents. And as soon as I read about this almost stranger than fiction mission, I had to read everything I could about it. So I went on CIA.gov and read all of those redacted documents right away.
Why was it perceived such a threat by the regime? Just remind us of some of the basics of the story. An epic love story, yes, but set against the backdrop of the Russian Revolution. And what was it in the novel that so perturbed those who wished to ban it?
Exactly. So it takes place between the Russian Revolution and the Civil War that followed. And what really made it subversive was its critique of groupthink and how different people experienced the revolution and its aftermath in different ways, and they had different opinions about it. Some benefited and some didn't. And Boris Pasternak wasn't afraid to show us all of those opinions and really giving us, you know, a nuanced balance of pros and cons for each, but at the same time talking about how groupthink can lead the Soviets down a troubled path. And I think that's what really was subversive and anti-Soviet about it.
Staying with the real story, or the factual story, before we look at some of the fiction that you interweave, what was Pasternak's endeavor to get the book published?
So during the Soviet Union, writers had to have a state-sponsored publishing company say that they will publish it first in the Soviet Union before it could be published anywhere abroad. And so Boris had sent his manuscript off to all of these publishing companies and did not hear a word back. And just a background on Boris, he was the most famous living writer in the Soviet Union during that time. So this is if, you know, the most famous writer today were to send their book off to the publishers and never hear back. And quickly, it became clear that this book was not going to be published. And what happened was the Italians got word that this book was finished, and they were the first people to publish it, despite pressure from the Soviet Union to return the manuscript post haste. And of course, then this led to it being a huge success in the West and setting it up for the CIA to use it in a mission to show the Soviet citizens that this great work of literature was banned from them and to question why.
Which brings us to your novel, and let's talk first a little more about the research that you went into to find out exactly what the CIA did and who did it. You mentioned you were looking into some documents. What was on record? What did you discover?
So the CIA has a website where it declassified about 99 to 100 documents. They're all redacted of the officers involved in the mission, but it details every step of the way of how they use Dr. Zhivago as a tool of propaganda, including using the Brussels World's Fair in 1958 as a staging ground to smuggle the book to Soviet visitors. And I initially came to it through that lens, and I was thinking, who are these people behind the redactions? And then I was thinking of, who are the people that type these memos and reports? Because those are the people that know the secrets behind these master secret keepers, which led to my first voice of the CIA's typing pool, which is one of the narrators of the novel. And, you know, that then led me to learn everything I could about the early days of the CIA and women spies in the CIA, then leading me into Boris Pasternak's personal story, which led me to Olga Ivanskaya, who was his real life mistress and muse. So I was just reading basically any primary research that I could find on it, and also talking to Cold War historians and experts on women spies. But then my travels took me to Russia during the writing of my first draft. And then I went to London and Paris as well. But that trip to Russia has, you know, left its mark on me because I got to see where Boris Pasternak lived and where he was buried. And it just was an unbelievable experience.
You have two threads, really, almost as you've outlined to the novel, the Western thread and then the Eastern thread, the Russia experiences that you had. And when it came to writing the book, did you almost have to approach each differently?
Yes, actually. I would spend long stretches of time focused on one character. So it goes back and forth between East and West, but there's about five different points of view that the novel is told through. So when I was spending time with one of the characters, say Sally, who was a character on the Western side, a woman spy, I would fully try to get into her mind by having pictures of 1950s women on my computer or hanging up in my office. And I would listen to old music from Washington, D.C. during that time. So I would really try to get in the mood for her mindset through different ways. And then when I would, say, go and write from Olga's perspective, I would listen to more somber classical music, Tchaikovsky and things like that to really set my mood. So it was kind of going back and forth and was having multiple personalities while I was writing it.
Her autobiography, was that the greatest insight that you could get into who she was and why she was the inspiration she was, the muse?
Absolutely. She wrote an autobiography called A Captive of Time, which was published in the 1970s. And she told her story of why Dr. Zhivago was seen as so subversive and its effects that it had not only on Boris Pasternak, but herself and her family. I mean, Olga was sentenced to the gulag not once, but twice due to her association with Boris Pasternak. And I started reading her book very early on in my during my first draft. And once I heard her words and all of the trials and tribulations that she'd gone through, and I just was really inspired to write from her perspective, because I'm really interested in that woman that's behind the man in the spotlight. That's why I wrote about the women spies of the CIA. And that's why I wrote about Olga.
Tell me more of those women. You mentioned the typing pool. Who were the women in real life on whom you modelled these characters? We call them a typing pool, but what had been their journey to be working there at the CIA?
Yeah, there's actually quite a few inspirations between because my fictional characters on the West, Irina and Sally, are very much based on bits and pieces of historic records between real women spies that I've read about. One of the books I consulted was a book called A Sisterhood of Spies, and it was written by Betty McIntosh, who herself was a spy during World War II with the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA. And then she eventually, when the CIA was established after the war was over, she went and worked for the CIA as well. And she has so many wonderful stories from her fellow agents and women who worked at the OSS and transitioned to the CIA, as well as just people she's met throughout her many, many years of service. So people like Virginia Hall is an inspiration. Betty McIntosh, as I said, even Julia Child, the famous French chef, was involved with the OSS. And so it was really fun learning about these women because to me, I had never heard about or read about these women in my history classes growing up. And I was shocked that they've done so much and contributed so much to the United States that there aren't monuments built in their honor. So it was just a pleasure learning about these women. In fact, today I received an email from a woman who had worked at the early days of the CIA in the typing pool, and I need to hop on the phone with her as soon as possible because she told me how many details I've gotten correct, and it just really made my day.
What efforts did they go to essentially spread what they saw as propaganda?
So the CIA had what they called its books program, which was a program that lasted up until the 1990s. And honestly, it still might be going on today. But they smuggled about 10,000 books and pamphlets into the Eastern Bloc during its time. But this was also part of a larger program of soft propaganda that the CIA waged during the Cold War. So it wasn't about, dictators and bombs and, instant change. It was really what they called the long tail of change, where you were planting seeds of dissent within citizens' minds. And hopefully, at least in their view, they would eventually start to question what was being kept from them and why. And so Zhivago was just one of the books used. There was many other books like Animal Farm and Nabokov and a few other like really famous books that made its impact in the Soviet Union, but it all added up with this kind of long tail soft propaganda game the CIA was playing.
You mentioned Virginia Hall. We've interviewed the author Sonia Pernell on her book about Virginia Hall.
Oh,
And
yes.
we're talking some frontline activity when we come to her work during the war. And was this the case that many of the women whom you've modelled this on had actually been in some pretty full-on activities during the Second World War? Were they fully utilised after the war, do you believe? How do you interpret what happened to them and their careers?
Yeah, well, I'm happy that you had her on because I love that book about Virginia Hall, A Woman of No Importance. And I'm so happy these women are getting more attention now. But yeah, so Virginia Hall's a prime example. She was on the front lines leading French resistance fighters to battle. She was in disguise. She was smuggling people. She did it with a prosthetic leg that she named Cuthbert. And so that sounds like right out of a spy movie, but this was her real life. But unfortunately, after the war was over, she was put behind a desk at the CIA and greatly underutilized. And I think this was the case for many women, where, after the war was over, there weren't the same amount of opportunities available to them. And this was going back into, from the very beginning of the CIA. And even though there may be a woman in charge of the CIA now, this has been a long, long change for the agency to make. And it's still, I think, rectifying what they had not used and what they didn't know about these amazing women.
Lara Prescott's my guest. We're talking about her novel, The Secrets We Kept, the fictionalised account of the battle to publish Dr. Zhivago, and particularly to have it published in countries where it had been banned by the Soviet Union. It's 26 minutes past 10. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Having done the research then, how difficult a book was it to write? As we said, we're in different parts of the world. We've got different narrators. Did it just flow for you?
Well, I will say that there was many times when I was writing this book that I didn't think I would finish, and thinking, why didn't I just set it, you know, here in Texas with one character in a house? Because it involved so much research and it involved, you know, so much traveling, and I was on a really shoestring budget at the time. So I didn't have, you know, I wasn't just able to go and live in Russia and London and Italy for a time. But at the same time, the process really showed me that I can do more than I thought I could as a novelist. And it was ambitious. And, you know, when I set out, when I started talking about this project with people, they said, this is really ambitious. And I said, well, I hope I can do it. And now that it's finished, I feel very proud of myself for kind of biting off maybe more than I could chew, because it really sets the bar higher for yourself, and you work harder to accomplish that goal.
It was the subject of a bidding war by publishers, an auction bidding war. What was your experience of that?
I was in I feel like I was living a surreal moment, because I had not even known that it was going to be published at all. And I'm a pessimist by nature. So I set my bar really, really low, that maybe it would not get published. Maybe I would come away with a rejection and no one would read this book that I'd spent years working on. So when I started hearing back from publishers and multiple publishers and that there would be an auction, I was almost having an out of body experience. I think I still am when I think about it all. But I just feel so happy that I found a home in the publishers that I did, because they really understood what I was trying to do and really published it and ushered out into the world in a way that I think many people will have the opportunity to read it.
With the highs, though, come the lows, and your publishers have had to defend you, really, with a plagiarism claim brought by the great niece of Anna Pasternak, which must have been gutting for you. And what can you tell us about this?
I mean, it was completely shocking and extremely sad for me to learn about these really unfounded claims. And I will say that I am happy to have the support of my publisher, and just, you know, knowing that no one has a copyright on history is something that just keeps me going. But I try not to dwell on any of that. To me, the response it's had with readers and people reaching out to me and telling me that they were so happy to learn about this story and that it's touched them in some way, that's what I focus on.
The essence, I understand, of the publisher's argument is that the story was known, and that the elements that you include in the book that she claims come from her own book, Lara, the Untold Love Story, that these were known facts. Is that the gist of it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's been written about numerous times. One from Olga Ivanskaya herself, from her daughter. There's a book that the Washington Post editors wrote, The Zhivago Affair. There's numerous books about this issue that were my primary resources.
Is it one of the challenges of fictionalizing factual events, and particularly perhaps in the literary world, that there's such sensitivity?
I think that is a challenge. I think that anytime you're dealing with historical people, or, you know, there could be, you know, experts or someone that has a differing opinion on history. But for me, I'm writing historical fiction. You know, I'm not writing a nonfiction book. This is my unique take on the events that come from my imagination as well as history. And to me, fiction has the opportunity to do things that nonfiction can't, which is to take you into the heads of these people, or the heads of how they must have experienced it and what they must have felt like. And that, to me, is the great power of novels. And so while it can be tricky, I don't think a world without historical fiction, or a world that you can't write about events that have happened in history, just seems crazy to me. I mean, Shakespeare was doing it. It's just been going back to the beginning of the written word that people were imagining what happened in a fictionalized way.
Having researched for the book and really immersed yourself in its real-life characters, has it caused you to rethink your own understanding of Dr. Zhivago as a novel and of Boris Pasternak as a novelist?
I think so. I try not to judge the author in the author's personal life and, what they did besides writing the book when I'm reading the book. But I think it gives you an interesting context of the stakes that were involved in writing such a book and the courage that it took that he gave this novel to foreign publishers, knowing that this could be the death of him, but he did it anyway. And I think that's the power of writing and the power of a master like Boris Pasternak, that I think it's hard for me not to think of, the novel that he put into the world without thinking of all of the events that unfolded because of it.
I'm interested that as well as your writing career, you've previously worked as a political campaign consultant, and propaganda is as alive and well in 2019 as it's ever been, including involving Russia, but pretty much involving everybody. And the US still uses soft diplomacy, as it's called, as a means of trying to spread its message. But does it cause you to ponder on the era we're in and the way we try to shape the message, get beyond the get into the depths of the human mind, really, and the human emotion with propaganda? Are you intrigued by the
Yeah.
current iteration of our political propagandizing?
Absolutely. I think as a former political campaigner, my job was to craft messages in advertisement, in videos, in speeches that would move the message and would change people's hearts and minds and get them to either vote one way or the other. And so I'm fascinated with propaganda. I think I used to be a propagandist in that job. And I'm also interested in how it's unfolding in current events where, we used books 60 years ago as tools of propaganda, but now we're using Twitter and Facebook and fake news. And it's something that can be done within an instant. Millions of people could see that piece of fake news. And it's a scary place to be in right now. And I could never have imagined just how close to home I can see the mere reflections of this Cold War that's never ended still playing out today. So I am interested. I think it's a theme I'll be interested in writing about it in the future, in future books, but it's a theme I've always been interested in.
And will the Cold War occupy you again? Perhaps again, as you say, these now being rediscovered, or for many, for the first time, undiscovered female operatives of the Cold War. Do you see further writing opportunities there?
I do. I don't know if the next book will be a Cold War era book, but I will say I am interested in women's stories. I'm interested in history and how it reflects what's going on today. So we'll see. And I'll never say never because, as we've seen Margaret Atwood return to the Testament so many years later, maybe I'll return to some of these characters someday in the future.
Thank you, Lara Prescott. The book is The Secrets We Kept, the publisher Penguin Random House, fictionalized account of the CIA operatives who undertook the mission to get Dr. Zhivago into countries where it had been banned as a propaganda exercise.